space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise.
Hey everybody, welcome to a video where we are going to be talking about comparing and contrasting, I guess, the comic version of City of, on the Edge of Forever with the original TV version, or I guess the original script, which got turned into a comic, versus the TV version. If you guys are unfamiliar, this is the Penske Podcast, where we're running through all the Star Trek episodes. We're currently up to TOS, and we got to City on the Edge, and one of the listeners wanted to hear our thoughts of comparing the comic, which is the original script sort of illustrated into a comic form. And how it lines up against the episode itself. So, we're joined by Clay, who's one of the most common guest stars that we have on the podcast. Clay, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very, very well.
Wishing I could use that time portal to go back in time and cook my breakfast a little bit better.
I thought you were going to relive the thrill of when you first saw this episode and just were blown away in wonder of it all.
No, I mean, I follow the Captain Kirk model of when to use unknown time machines, and that's to do really insignificant stuff.
Yep. Either go back to the 1960s and fight fighter jets, or go back in time for no particular reason at all, like they did in No Man, where No Man Has Gone Before. But we've read the comic book. We've talked about the episode. You guys can go hear what our thoughts about the TV episode are. This is going to be pretty short. We're just going to run through what I wrote down is a couple notes about the differences between the comic, which is the original script version, and the TV show. So we'll start it off with Clay, did you read the introductory letter by Harlan Ellison, the original writer of the episode?
Oh, no. No, I actually didn't.
It's really highly recommended, I think, that people read it. He starts off with, it's basically like, he's like, people might consider me an asshole. He's like, and he breaks into this thing where he's like, you know, sometimes people will ask you if you look fat in something, and I'm always one to tell them when they look fat, and it's like, it's cost me friends. It's really weird. He goes off on this tangent, and then he just says, but anyway, this book is really great, and I'm really glad that everyone was able to was able to make it. So I recommend everyone read that. And then it launches.
He's notoriously prickly.
Oh, is he really?
There's a whole documentary about him that's definitely worth a watch.
What has he done besides this script that people would know?
He's a very famous sci-fi writer.
Okay.
And he did a lot of Twilight Zone stuff and a lot of I think he did a lot of Outer Limits stuff. He actually, one of the famous court cases that he was involved in was I can't remember if he wrote both of these episodes, but there's an episode of, I think, The Twilight Zone and an episode of The Outer Limits that are very similar when combined to the concept of the Terminator.
Okay.
And I believe he wrote one of them, if not both of them, and they were in litigation for a long time. And now any new version of the Terminator that you watch has something in the credits that says acknowledging the work of Harlan Ellison.
Huh, interesting. Yeah, so he wrote the original script, which was rewritten. Some would say heavily. I would not say heavily. And then he came along and IDW Publishing turned his script into a comic book under the title Star Trek. Harlan Ellison's original The City on the Edge of Forever teleplay. Jesus, that's quite a mouthful. And then it was artwork by J.K. Woodward, and it was written by Scott and David Tipton. So I guess we'll just start off with the differences here. So what did you think of the art, I guess, to start off with this one? And what did you think of the comic in general, like in terms of how it looks as opposed to the plotting of it?
I thought it was pretty good. You know, the art style is very different than most comics art is, where it's all fairly realistically painted.
Yeah, it looks like watercolor slightly to me. It's not watercolor, but it kind of reminds me of watercolor.
I think it probably is. It's tough to tell these days. It could be watercolor. It could also be digital.
Okay.
I'm not entirely positive. I think it might be digital, but I if it's not, I apologize to the artist.
Well, I mean, it has like a very like saturated look to the watercolor, which made me wonder about it. So it's probably enhanced if it's not originally watercolor or something.
Well,
like
if
that.
if it isn't watercolor, it might be gouache, which is a an opaque watercolor that's a little bit thicker than watercolor usually is.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Yeah. I think his likenesses are really good. The artist's likenesses are really good for the most part. And it's just it's a lot of work. I mean, doing a comic, just drawing it is difficult enough.
Yeah.
So to do one fully painted like this, you know, I definitely hats off to the artist here.
That's why the book costs $10, I suppose, probably. Right? Yeah.
I think it can be a little distracting in some places, but overall, I think it's probably the best way to do it because. You know, if you're redoing something that was famously an episode of the TV show, if you can basically do a printed version of what it would have been like if they shot the TV show this way, that makes a lot of sense to do. So I can see why they went for the very hyper realistic style as opposed to like a normal comic book style.
Yeah, the only scene that really stuck out to me, the one where Kirk and Spock put on their sort of stolen clothing, mm-hmm. is basically he painted the scene from the TV show.
Yes.
So that was the only one that I really was like, oh, that's exactly the same thing. But that one stuck out for me for whatever reason. But I like the artwork. I think it's kind of neat to look at. It's like sort of whimsical, and I think it works with the sort of fantasy-esque type story that they get into, especially with the city on the edge of forever, which we'll get into.
Yeah, that I thought that was great. The stuff that he did, I think it's a he. I'm sorry if it's not.
Yeah,
is really nice because in our actual episode we did covering the episode of the show, one of the things I mentioned was you can see where. They definitely did not have the budget to do on the show probably what was in the script because
right.
the way and since you know production budget isn't really a thing when you're drawing or painting, you can do much more elaborate stuff. And the way that they handled the city was really cool here.
Yeah, they obviously the title of the episode for the TV show means nothing compared to what the original script had it actually being, where instead it's just one portal, it's actually a big city. And J.K. Woodward is a guy, apparently. I'm looking at him now. But
okay.
Let's. I guess we'll break into the differences here. So the main thing that's changed is the reason that they go back in time. It's no longer
yes.
McCoy in the original story. McCoy isn't actually even in the script at all, I don't think.
No, I don't think he shows up at all.
So what they do is they have – apparently there's a drug dealer on board the Enterprise who has gotten a fellow Enterprise person hooked on these Juul drugs. And that guy gets real high and goes on the bridge and Spock yells at him. So that guy then goes back to the drug dealer and says, I'll tell everyone what you've done. You've gotten me addicted to drugs. And even if it ruins my career, I'm going to take you down with me. The guy murders him, I think. And then he jumps into the transporter to escape security forces and he beams mm-hmm. down to the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So the entire script is basically Kirk and Spock hunting this guy who's a criminal and is responsible for A, drug dealing, and B, possibly murder. And they're going back in time to bring him back. And they also reveal that him going back in time has changed the past for some reason.
Right.
It's too dark for Star Trek, right? Mm-hmm. That's basically the first takeaway. If it was actually in the episode, it would feel really out of place to have this drug dealing guy aboard the ship.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm glad that they changed that. Was there any part of it that you like regretted that they got rid of that?
Of that plot specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I think the McCoy, sending McCoy back, no matter how clunkily they did it to get McCoy into the past, I think it's a better story if it's McCoy.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like the in the episode, what they do, what sending McCoy back does is it makes whatever interaction that happens a lot less malicious.
Yeah.
Whereas this way, if you're sending a drug dealing murderer back in time, I guess you could say that it might amp up the necessity to bring him to justice or something, or
right.
like the possibility of him doing much more harm. But I don't think it fits as well with what the story ends up being, because it's not a chase story. It's just sort of like a hanging around story.
Right, yeah.
And if the guy that they're after is actively malicious and murderous or whatever, it makes the hanging around aspect feel a lot different and weird.
Yeah, yeah. It's what I think the problem with sending that guy back is it takes away the character stuff that I think is better in the TV show than it is mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. I think that, like, even down to the end of it, like when they sort of bring him back and everything, I think that and I guess we just jump to the end. In the end of this, the guy that they're after tries to save Keeler for some mm-hmm. reason. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense in the original script why they do it. And the show actually, or the script actually ends with Spock and Kirk talking about why he would do that.
Yeah.
And it makes it much better if Kirk has to actively hold McCoy back from doing it. As yes. opposed to, yeah. in the original script, it's Spock who, you know, Kirk can't bring himself to action. So Spock has to jump out and stop the guy from saving the woman who's about to get hit by the car, which to me completely ruins anything that they're going for in terms of the love story here about what Kirk has to sacrifice to make things better.
Yeah, yeah. I think overall, the TV script is just a lot tighter. I think they cut out a lot of extraneous stuff and really focused it a little bit more on the important stuff that they were doing, which is the Kirk and Keeler stuff. Because, I mean, there's a whole sequence where in the comic where after, you know, what's his name? I don't even know if he has a name. But
Beckwith, the criminal?
Beckwith?
Beckwith, yeah. I think that's
after
it.
Beckwith jumps into the portal, they beam themselves back up to the ship, and then the ship, it's like an alternate dimension.
Yeah, that
and the ship is run terrible. By, like...
They're basically like, mercs or something.
Yeah, like pirates or
yeah,
something.
Yeah.
And it's like, that doesn't make sense for a lot of reasons. Why would...
I think...
Why would there be pirates on the Enterprise? Why would the... You know, they solve that problem in the show. Not only is it an unnecessary and extraneous, like, action beat
yes.
for a show...
Yep.
And answer and brings up a whole bunch of different questions.
It also does one thing we talked about in the TV episode where they do cut back to the crew members who have sealed themselves in the transporter room in the comic. Like, what, you know how we were talking about in the show,
yeah.
they never cut back to, like, what's Uhura up to on back
right.
in the past. They do that in the comic. You see them cutting back to the crew. It's only for, like, a panel or two, but you see them sort of standing there as the mercenaries are trying to cut their way into the room.
Yeah, and that whole thing, I guess it's there to add tension because the mercenaries are trying to get out. But it's like it doesn't matter because you're dealing with time travel anyway, so things aren't working linearly anyway.
Right, yeah.
Cutting that out for the show really simplifies everything but doesn't take away any of the stakes because you still have Scotty and Uhura and the other guys in red trapped on the planet, and so it's like it's all still there, and but it makes more sense. It's a much tighter told story in the show, I think.
Yes, I think so too. One of the other big changes is that in the comic, the past is much more racist than it is in the episode. They call Spock a Chinee. Couple times. Yeah, Chinee
yeah.
a couple times, and when they first arrive, they actually. They don't get attacked or they don't get accosted by a policeman. They get accosted by an angry mob who sees Spock and assumes that he's Chinese.
Right.
So there's a lot more. In the comic, the past is seen as much more of a terrible situation, which maybe makes sense being on the eve of World War II, but mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessary in terms of anything. I think the show did a smart job of not paying much credence to that.
Mm. There's also a much larger through line. You know, in the show episode, we were talking about how the time that the show was made is relative to the Second World War as the time period that they go to is relative to the First World War.
Right.
And they really kind of play that up a lot in the comic. There's like a whole – I don't want to say it's a subplot, but there's a much bigger string of
war references and stuff.
Yeah, and there's a whole character that – The character we talked about in the show, that homeless guy who
yep.
just blows himself up for no reason.
In the pointless
actually,
scene with McCoy, yeah.
Yeah, in the comic, he actually, I don't want to say he has a point, but they do a lot more with him, and he has a little bit more, point to him than he does in the show. And also the character, he's like a legless World War One veteran who fought in Verdun. That character is drawn is in the likeness of Harlan Ellison. So that's what Harlan Ellison looks like.
Oh, that's interesting.
I believe he still has both of his legs.
The situation with the homeless person in the TV episode is really kind of a pointless scene.
Yeah.
And in the script, Kirk gives him $2 to sort of inform him as to where Beckwith is.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they're chasing him, Beckwith fires a phaser back at Kirk, and the homeless guy jumps in and gets shot by it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Kirk has this thing about he did it because they kind of have a weird rationale. He's like, I gave him $2, so he felt it was necessary to sacrifice his life for me, which doesn't make a lot of sense. But in the comic, at least they make a bigger deal of why some deaths are okay, why you can have some interactions in the past that don't change things.
Yeah, that's another thing I just thought was kind of extraneous. Like, why even bother? You know, I don't know.
I like the analogy of time as a river, and like you can do things like you could stick a branch in and it kind of just collects it. Like the water goes around the branch, but it goes back to normal. Or you could dam up the river, which completely changes the flow of time. Kind of thing.
Yeah, I like that too. That's a good way to think about this fake stuff. I don't know. That's a weird thing to bring up though. Like, isn't that sort of strange? Like, just having one character mean the entire the change in the entire flow of time, and then one character's just like, he didn't mean anything anyway, even though he fought in the war.
It is.
I don't know. It's just an odd point to make, I guess.
Yeah, I feel it would have a. I feel anything changing like that would have, you know, you're not going to know it in real time, but if you went back and you compared things, maybe, you know, the butterfly effect seems like it would logically eventually have very big changes that would go along with it. I don't know, but I thought that was an interesting. It was a much better way to serve that homeless character, than in the TV episode, which doesn't really do anything with it.
I guess it is a better way to handle the concept of the butterfly effect sort of thing. Because if you establish that not every little change equals a tidal wave, it allows you to tell stories a lot easier.
Yeah,
because you're not worried about like, well, I mean, Kirk stole an apple from this guy, so maybe that now in history that guy he is homeless, and then his family dies, and you know, like it,
yep.
that whole stepping on a bug in prehistory wipes out man or something like that,
right? Yeah,
you know that old chestnut.
They do it as a way to sort of explain how you can go into the past, because the comic actually makes it sound like this is the first time Kirk has ever heard of time travel. Like, and we've had episodes before this where he's gone back in time, so it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they treat the time travel aspect very delicately. Even like, I think they're called the Guardians of Forever. Basically the portal that sends them back.
Yeah, he does sort of have a response where he's like, wait a minute, it's pizza and a bagel?
Yes. You can have this anytime. And outside of that, I think the other major sort of big change is that I much prefer the way that the story plays out of how they meet Edith Keeler in the TV episode than here. Here, in the comic book, they know that she's the focal point of time before they meet her. And in the TV episode, they meet her, and then they learn that she's the one that has to die for this to happen.
Yeah, that's no good.
Yeah, you're saying that the comic book is no the way that they do it in the comic.
Yeah. I don't like the way that they do it in the comic. Yeah.
Right, because it sort of taints the relationship, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Kirk is after her for duplicitous reasons in the original script, as opposed to falling in love with her and then realizing what this means for him.
Yeah, and they also again, it's another aspect that they tighten up in the show. Excuse me. Where she's not the person who finds them in the basement. Like, it's a completely different character who finds them in the basement, who then serves no other purpose than to like bring them out to the street or something. Like, it's just that the way that they meet her in the comic is just a lot more needlessly complicated.
Mm-hmm. And it was an overly written thing. Before they go back in time, the Guardian tells them some sort of random poem. He's like, the sky will be blue with the sun shining on it, and there'll be a key nearby.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that stuff was lame.
And then Spock runs into her. She's wearing a blue jacket, and she has a sun pin on, and her last name is Keeler. So it's like this must be the woman from the thing.
It reminded me a lot of one of my favorite things from the 60s Batman show is anytime the Riddler would leave a riddle, it was always something completely preposterous that made no sense whatsoever.
Right.
And then, like, Robin would be like, oh, of course, it's a monkey wearing a top hat.
Right.
You know, something like that. And it was the same kind of thing where that connection for Spock to make that connection is pretty preposterous.
Or just to make the connection or just have the Guardian not speak in riddles. It hasn't been speaking in riddles the entire time. Mm-hmm. Why does it need to just start doing it now? I thought that was kind of a strange thing. And then the only other major real change I can think of is that Spock is much more militant in Edith Keeler Must Die in the comic.
Mm-hmm.
There's even a scene where he shows up with a phaser and Kirk's like, you didn't bring that to kill.
Oh,
Beckwith.
Yeah. I forgot about that. Right, where he's like, here, you're just going to have to shoot her in the face.
And then at the very end, as I mentioned before, Spock is the one that stops Beckwith from attacking her, or not attacking, from saving her. And that's what causes everything to go back to normal.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. I think it's just generally, you know, Harlan Ellison is primarily a novelist, or at least a prose writer.
Yep.
So I can see why he would write more than he needs to.
Right.
But I don't think I can't remember. Did you say that intro? Does he talk negatively about the way that the show?
No, he just talks about how everyone doesn't like him, and he is not faint with praise. But he wasn't in the intro to that. He did not mention that he thought the show screwed things up. I was kind of, now that you've explained his sort of personality, I was kind of taken aback by the research where he was so affronted by what Roddenberry had done, because I don't think the idea is all that different from what he originally pitched to them.
Oh, I was there a fight between them?
Yeah, apparently Roddenberry and him had a falling out about this.
Oh, that's weird.
Because like, I think the TV show, to sum up what we've been talking about, the TV show is a more streamlined, better version of the original story, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think you might lose a little bit of some of the subtext that he was going for, but I don't think it's very subtextual the way he does it. I think it's pretty much, you know, right in your face.
Right, yeah.
I think some of it doesn't cross over as well. Like, I don't think they keep at least one of Edith Keeler's long-winded speeches about the future, and I don't think that plays well in the show, and I don't really know. You know, maybe it, I don't know if it necessarily plays better on the page either. But
I think it plays worse in the comic than on the screen. But I don't think the screen was like a Shakespeare or anything. It was a little bit too much on the nose for me when she's like, soon we'll be in space with warp drive.
Yeah, I think, you know, that whole aspect of it is questionable to me. Because I don't think you really need that for her character. I mean, unless it's there specifically to make Kirk fall in love with her faster, like her sense of optimism.
Yeah.
But she's so specific about what the future is going to be like.
Yes.
Like, you know, I think in the last episode I mentioned Back to the Future 3, and it's actually a very similar thing. And at least in Back to the Future 3, Clara Clayton isn't talking verbosely about people going to the stars and everything.
Right.
So when Doc Brown brings it up, she's like, that's really bad of you to, you know, I don't know how you knew that I was a fan of Jules Verne, but you shouldn't use that against me.
Right.
You know, like they end up bonding over it the same way that they do in the show, but it's a much cleaner through line than her just being like, one of these days we're going to be flying around in starships for a Federation of Planets, and there's going to be people with bumps on their foreheads.
There will be a new generation, a next generation.
You should fly the spaceship.
I think that they included Keeler's sort of speeches about that as a way to sort of increase the tragedy of her death. Like she was, like Spock says, she was kind of born in the wrong time.
Yeah.
And it's to really just highlight the fact that even though her cause was good, in order to get to the end point that she wants, she can't be around for it.
Yeah. It is I think we talked about this a little bit in the show episode, but it is kind of weird too how she's so positive about the future, And then the whole thing is like, no, if she's allowed to spread that too far, then everything
right.
in the world
we
will
just
be over.
The allies all become pussies and they can't stand up.
Yeah,
to
it's
Hitler.
Weird. It's a weird, it's kind of a weird, weird look.
Yeah.
They probably could have done it a little bit smoother and have it not be as, you know.
Well, do you think it's a product of the time? Like, you know, I don't know a huge amount of World War II history, but the U.S. was very reticent to get into the war. You know what I
right.
mean? So
right.
would one figurehead who suddenly took the national stage have been enough to stop the U.S. eventually getting into the war with things?
Well, I don't know. I mean, how does Edith Keeler feel about the fact that Pearl Harbor got bombed?
Right, yeah. And I wonder if it's due to the fact that, as you mentioned, the script was actually only written about 20 years after the World War had ended. So was it more fresh in people's mind back then than us looking back on it now? It seems a little bit silly almost.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure that does play into it too, because, I mean, it's I'm sure maybe – you know, I don't know what Ellison's politics are, but maybe it was the kind of thing where people were already looking back saying maybe we shouldn't have gone into this war. And he was like, well, no, you know, we probably should have.
Right.
You
know, yeah.
Who knows? I don't know what where he was coming from.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I think the episode and the comic both play nicely into that, his original script. So I guess we'll wrap it up with what I think is the biggest mistake of the comic compared to the TV show, where they end it by wondering why Beckwith saved her. I don't understand why that is your button scene. It casts a terrible character in this sort of ambiguous light. It totally distracts from what I think the main narrative is, where it's about Kirk's sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And it just felt silly. I'm glad that they sort of got rid of that whole thing, mostly to avoid that ending.
Yeah, it's a really weird way to undercut all of the emotional work that you do.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I can't come up with a single reason why that character, who has been shown to be terrible, would do that at the very end.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's supposed to be some sort of, like, you know, in order for where good things can bad things can happen at, because good people do things.
The plant good grows out of the pile of shits or whatever that.
Yeah, yeah, that, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I'm not crazy about it. Would you? So I guess to wrap up, would you consider the TV version to be the better version of this story? Or
I think so.
I think I agree with that.
I think, you know, it's also because I think I just think it's tighter. And this felt really long to read.
Yeah.
And they didn't say much more than they do in the show, I didn't think, personally.
No, I think they might actually say less because they sort of obscure what they're talking about a couple times too many.
Yeah. I think it's nice that they did it. You know, I'm a big fan of seeing where things came from and early versions of stuff. They did a similar – I think it was – maybe it wasn't IDW. It was either IDW or maybe it was Dark Horse, because I think Dark Horse might have still had the rights to Star Wars at the time. They did a similar version – a similar thing to this with Star Wars, where they did Lucas's original draft of Star Wars.
Yep.
So it has all the, like, it's got Luke Starkiller in it and all that kind of original stuff that people are always talking about,
sure.
But, you know, you've never seen before.
Yeah.
I haven't read it, but I'm always a fan of going back and seeing how, where stuff came from and how things changed and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I guess you could also see how maybe multiple drafts of something can actually improve it after a while. It's not always the purest form is maybe not always the best for the point that you're trying to get across. But
yeah, you know, I think as someone who's a creative writer and artist myself, you can get blinded by your own work very easily, and sometimes it's difficult to admit where when it gets into someone else's hands, the cuts that they make actually improve it.
Right.
You
know? Yeah.
And I think this is probably one of those cases. I mean, I know that famously, writers, when they get on, like, you know, the level of Stephen King or Anne Rice, the first thing they do is they stop using editors.
Right.
And their work is generally worse because of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we always sort of trash Roddenberry, but I think he did a good job here. And it might be maybe you could argue it's kind of the freewheeling sort of inner conflict between like your original artistic version and Roddenberry's much more like corporatized view? Like Roddenberry's not a great storyteller, but he understands sort of what how you sell the show and what the show is supposed to be like to get it on TV and stuff like that. And the Ellison version is much more of a like an emotional sort of all over the place story that is like the original genesis. And I think Roddenberry did a good job of tying it down to really the essence of what it's supposed to be. He doesn't always do that well, but he did it well in this case.
Yeah, I think so too. And if it wasn't him, whoever the story editor was on the show just did a really good
job. Yeah, Gene L. Coon, I guess, is the sort of unsung hero of early Star Trek. Who has, according to everything I've been watching, done most of the rewrites of all the episodes that come out. So Gene L. Coon might be the, and I guess Shatner in his autobiography went out of his way to sort of praise Gene L. Coon at the expense of Roddenberry.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so that was kind of an interesting thing. But
or not nice, I guess.
But yeah, not well, Roddenberry's dead, so I guess he doesn't care about it at this point. But that's it. Well, Clay, thanks for talking about the comic. Thanks for reading it.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for letting me read it.
And guys, you can check out the Edge City on the Edge of Forever that we talked about the actual episode. I'll link to that show right now.
They should do a new version called City on the Edge of Tomorrow, which mixes this story with that Tom Cruise movie.
Yeah. City on the Edge of Yesterday, where it's yesterday's Enterprise appears in the distance.
With Tom Cruise as his character from City on the Edge of Tomorrow.
Guys, thank you very much for listening. If you enjoyed this content and you're new, you can check out the podcast. Otherwise, we will see you later.